I'm Harrison Moore, Vice President for Development at Cato, as Bob said, overseeing our fundraising, working closely with our board of directors, and serving on our leadership team. Pleasure to be here with all of you. Thanks so much for your support and joining us. It's my pleasure to introduce our next speakers, investigative reporter Matt Taibbi and the Cato Institute's Gene Healy, for a keynote conversation on free speech and the preservation of democracy. We're thrilled to have Matt join us to discuss this important and timely topic because he brings a wealth of experience to this conversation as a longtime journalist and writer who has more recently questioned legacy media, how it interacts with the government, and whether it's serving its role as a key institution of civil society. I'll let Gene thoroughly introduce Matt and just add that we're looking forward to you expanding on what you've learned through your reporting on the Twitter files and the government's effort to coerce private speech. You're a champion for a free and civil society, so thanks for continuing to speak truth to power. And as Senior Vice President for Policy, my colleague Gene Healy is Cato's Chief Quality Control Officer, Chief Editor, who ensures that Cato continues to produce rigorous analytical research and content that is in line with our mission. The buck stops with Gene in maintaining Cato's credibility in Washington, which is really number one for us. Gene's the author of The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power, which on its release, George Will called the year's most pertinent and sobering public affairs book. Please join me in welcoming Gene and Matt to the stage.
Thanks, Harrison, and thanks to all of you for being here for this conversation on free speech and the preservation of our democracy. It dies in the darkness, I'm told by the Washington Post. But lately, as Harrison alluded to, some of the biggest scoops in terms of revelations of government wrongdoing aren't coming from legacy media. They're not coming as frequently from outlets like the Post. They've been broken by independent journalists like Matt outside of institutional media. Matt has had a long and distinguished career in journalism, a longtime political reporter, columnist for Rolling Stone, winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for columns and commentary. But in early 2020, he left Rolling Stone, a dream job, to hang out his own shingle at Substack, where his racket news is near the top of the charts with over 400,000 subscribers, unless it's gone up since the last time I looked. And as I said, he's broken some of since he's done that, he's broken some of the most important stories of our time. Most famous lately for the Twitter files, where he got a look under the hood at Twitter at a trove of internal communications that showed a massive federal effort to lean on social media companies to suppress protected speech. More recently, with Michael Schellenberger, some new revelations about the intelligence community's interference in political activity, that the spying on the Trump campaign started much earlier than we and went a bit further than we had been told it had been. But let me tell you, we'll get to both of those, but let me tell you a little bit more about Matt first. I've said this before, but usually when I'm doing this sort of thing, I'll be introducing maybe a career academic or worse, a career politician, and they're not the most interesting people in the world most of the time. So you go looking through their truffle hunting in their official bios to try to find some little spark of adventure, something interesting about them. For Matt, you don't have to go looking. It's an embarrassment of riches right there in the resume. Around the time he graduated college, the Soviet Union conveniently collapsed, and he went east. It's from the official bio, he focused on participatory journalism, working in a series of jobs to show ordinary Russian life. Bricklayer in Siberia, moonshine dealer, professional clown, keeper in an elephant cage, construction worker in an Orthodox monastery. He was, according to Wikipedia anyway, deported from Uzbekistan in 1992 for writing an article for the Associated Press critical of President Islam Karimov. At the time of his deportation, Taibbi was the starting left fielder for the Uzbek national baseball team. He later moved on to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, where he played professional basketball and became known as the Mongolian Rodman. He even had a turn as Philip Marlowe, working for a time as an investigator in a Boston-based private detective agency. All of which, I guess, is good background for the stories that he's been digging up. I'd like to start with the Twitter files. When you got a look at this cache of documents, internal memoranda, communications at Twitter, you know, tell us about how that started and what you found, and you know, which aspects of it were most concerning.
Sure. First of all, thank you, Gene, for that incredibly generous introduction and for everybody for coming out. It's a huge crowd. Thank you for being here. Well, it's interesting that you asked that question because Harrison was talking about conventional media. The reason that the new owner of Twitter, Elon Musk, reached out to me and then subsequently a group of other independent journalists to do what turned into a story called the Twitter Files was, among other things, because he didn't trust conventional media to report the story correctly. So he very specifically picked out independent journalists, people who weren't affiliated, at least anymore, with mainstream organizations. That included me. I had been at Rolling Stone, Barry Weiss, who had been at the New York Times. But I was the first one brought in, and the idea behind this, and they hadn't even looked at the files yet, but Elon wanted the public to know the extent to which platforms like Twitter were censoring their own customers. And I think his idea behind this, at least as how it was expressed to me, is that he wanted to restore trust in the institution by sort of opening the kimono and letting the public know what was going on. But at that time, we only had a very distant idea that there might be some kind of government angle to this. At the very extreme end, we thought maybe there would be one or two letters from the FBI suggesting stay away from this story or that story. This is why we picked, as our first subject, the Hunter Biden laptop story, which we knew had been blocked by Twitter and Facebook in what I thought was a historic moment for internet platforms in this country. We didn't actually find a whole lot from the FBI with that story, but then they allowed us to look kind of freely through some other files, particularly with regard to the 2020 election, and we started to see emails all over the place saying things like flagged by DHS, flagged by FBI, flagged by a whole variety of government agencies, and we didn't know what that meant. And it took about 3 weeks to a month for us to figure out that there was a very organized and extensive, I guess you would call it a content flagging operation, where tens of thousands of social media posts had been picked out by various government organizations, in particular the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, and they had been sent to companies like Twitter, along with about two dozen others, through a pretty formal system of content management. And that became the backbone of this story that we thought was significant because we had no idea that there was a big content moderation program going on with government. We subsequently found out that this was a huge fundraising issue as well. There were well over $100 million just from one agency involved in this kind of activity, for instance. So this was a very sizable program, and we were very fortunate to be able to uncover it.
And what kind of speech are we talking about? Because I think, people who haven't followed the story much think, You know, first they came for Alex Jones, and I wasn't crazy, so I did nothing. Or they think it's, you know, what the core of, you know, their term disinformation would be. But my understanding is that you have an effort in the COVID area to suppress some information that's actually true from highly credible medical sources.
Yeah, and this was a big surprise for us. Well, at first we thought that all the things that they were trying to flag, there were some things that were sort of blatantly, obviously misinformation. The most common kind of communication that the FBI would complain about would be a social media post that would say, hey, Democrats, don't forget to go out and vote on Wednesday, right? And there were, this was sort of like spam that would be sent out, the whole idea being to get people to forget to vote on Tuesday. That doesn't seem terribly objectionable, but then we started to find things that were clearly protected, you know, constitutional speech, that they were recommending. They were saying, we think this violates your terms of service. And that might be like there was one thing that was a spoof video that someone had created making fun of the Biden administration's messaging on COVID. Essentially, it was a phony mesothelioma ad where you're looking 10 years into the future and you're saying, hey, if you got the vaccine 10 years ago, please call 1-800-THIS-LAWYER. Clearly a joke. You know, whether it's funny or not is up to you, but it's exactly the kind of thing that the First Amendment was designed to protect. And they were recommending, you know, that the Twitter take a second look. And then we found things that were more nefarious than that. There were these private cross-platform programs, you know, some of them associated with big academic institutions that talked openly about how we have to consider suppressing true content that might promote vaccine hesitancy. So an example of that would be somebody gets the vaccine, they die of myocarditis. That's true, it happened, but we don't think it's a good story. It's not politically true, right? It's going to produce an adverse political consequence. So let's list that as a disinformation event. They actually had a term for this kind of content. They call it malinformation. It's not disinformation, not misinformation. Malinformation is something that is true, but produces an adverse result. And this, we thought, was extremely dangerous because it was a way to get around, you know, the general journalistic idea, which is, if it's true, we print it. We don't care. It's up to the public to figure out what to do with it. But now they were doing something very different entirely.
Well, how do you explain the tepid and even dismissive reaction, for massive covert government effort to suppress speech? It seemed to me that the reaction in a lot of the legacy media and from a lot of elite opinion leaders was sort of nothing burger, not a big deal. There was some personal, quite a few personal attacks on you. What happened to you, man?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. This isn't helpful.
Right.
Well, how do you, in a 10 or so years before, you know, you didn't see that when the Snowden revelations came out. People, whether it burnt Obama or George W. Bush, people were interested in a massive secret government surveillance program. But it seemed that the reaction to the Twitter files was very different.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating thing. I think in this new era, since 2016, any issue that, you know, as we talked about before, any issue that codes as a Trump issue, is sort of denounced and dismissed and set aside. I found myself sort of instantly recharacterized as a conservative Trump-leaning journalist, even though, you know, there's nothing in my biography that suggests that. I wrote a book called Insane Clown, Clown President about Donald Trump. The Washington Post, in the days after the story first broke, they described me as conservative journalist Matt Taibbi. Then they sort of silent edited that in, within a few hours after people complained. But basically, yes, I mean, there was a mysterious reaction, I thought, from a lot of people in the press who should be concerned about this because it's, you know, fundamentally affects them as much as anybody else. But they didn't see it as a very dangerous issue. And what's interesting about this, if you go back to 1974, there was a big story in the New York Times by Seymour Hersh that came to be known as the Family Jewel story, where Psy found out about this CIA program that was designed to engage in widespread illegal domestic surveillance, infiltration, and I even talked to Hersh about this when I was, you know, asking for advice about what to do about the story. And it was a very similar thing because a lot of the agencies that were involved in this domestic censorship stuff were expressly prohibited from doing so in America. A lot of them were foreign intelligence agencies or the State Department. And that story, too, engendered, that Hersh did, engendered a lot of hostility from other people in the media who thought it went too far, that you shouldn't write about this kind of thing because it can hurt important institutions in this country. So it got us, I think, into a very dicey area where there were people who thought that there are some secrets that don't need to get out.
Yeah, that's a good tie-in, speaking of the intelligence community, to your recent reporting on efforts to surveil the Trump campaign that happened much earlier than we'd originally understood. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've uncovered there?
Sure, and there have been a lot of reporters on both the left and the right over the course of the last 6 or 7 years who've hinted at this. There was a House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, nicknamed HPSI. They had done an investigation in 2017 and 2018 into the origins of the scandal that came to be known as Russiagate, but only a portion of their research ever got out. That was the part about the misuse of FISA and the sort of misfiled warrant on a gentleman named Carter Page. But there was a lot of other stuff that never got out, and people who followed this story knew that there were other things that were out there. That other shoe just didn't fully drop until last week or a couple of weeks ago when we had sources who told us a couple of major things, one of them being that there were at least 26 people in the around the Trump campaign who were placed under surveillance without legitimate predication well before the beginning of the opening of the FBI investigation in the summer of 2016. And then the other thing was that the an intelligence community assessment of January 2017, which said that the Russians had conducted an influence campaign specifically to help Trump, that this was cooked intelligence, that they had suppressed dissenting information that, among other things, suggested the Russians were, the actual quote was, with Hillary Clinton, it was a relationship they were comfortable with. They felt that she was manageable and reflected continuity. But the people, this small handpicked team of people who put together this report, downgraded reliable sources, upgraded unreliable ones, and that's how that story came out. But an important thing about this is my feeling on this, and we haven't exactly been able to prove this out yet, is that one of the reasons that this happens is not really Trump specific. It's just that there is widespread misuse of this particular kind of authority, this 702 FISA authority, also the unmasking authority that they use to find out which U.S. persons have been monitored abroad. I think at the end of the day, we're going to find out that was a big reason that this happened. And that's very pertinent, I think, to Cato's mission.
Yeah, there's, if I come back to the Twitter files for a second, you know, all this talk about the 70s and government spying, you know, brings up these sort of paranoid thrillers that were big.
Days of the Condor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Parallax View and stuff like that. And there's a story from, you know, the fallout from the Twitter files that you know, if I didn't know it was true, I would think was crazy, which was, you know, that the release of the Twitter files led to some hearings by Jim Jordan's committee on the weaponization, subcommittee on the weaponization of the federal government. You testified there, and the same day that you testified before the committee back in March, an IRS agent showed up at your house.
Yeah.
Which is a hell of a coincidence.
Yeah. I testified in Washington that day. I took the train home. I live in New Jersey. Got home that night, found out from my wife that there had been a note had been left in the door saying, you know, hey, the IRS came and visited. We'd like to talk to you, but don't call us for 4 days. I found out that's a tactic, apparently. They like to let you worry over the weekend what it is that you've done wrong. And I thought this was too stupid to be related to any of my, you know, journalism work. So I did inform the committee that this had happened, but I didn't say anything about it publicly because I didn't want to give the impression that I was being a conspiracy theorist or anything like that. It wasn't until Jim Jordan's committee got some answers back from the Treasury that I really started to get nervous, because it turned out that the case on me had been opened on Christmas Eve of 2022, which was a Saturday, and it was also the day of the probably the biggest Twitter file story that was directly about the CIA, FBI, and the Director of National Intelligence. So if you can imagine the IRS opening a case on the afternoon of Christmas Eve on a Saturday, that's when I got nervous. It could still be a coincidence, but it's the kind of thing, you know, I lived in Russia for a long time. Like it definitely struck a chord. Yeah.
Just one more before we open it up for audience questions. Sort of overarching theme here. It ties in with the tepid reaction to the Twitter files, the hey, whose side are you on sort of reaction to some of the other reporting. What do you think has happened to free speech culture and old school nonpartisan civil libertarianism in this country? How much of it is the particularly polarizing figure of Donald Trump, who seems to have melted everyone's brains? And how much of it is, you know, you gave a speech at Freedom Fest where you talked about the kids today and how they grow up marinating in social media and obsessed with call-out culture. And what do you think is the mix that has led us away from, you know, a period in the 80s and 90s where, you know, the cool thing to do was to be for free speech, you know, without reservation?
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, I grew up, as you say, I grew up in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Every culture war story about speech, it was a litmus test issue for anybody who considered themselves a political liberal, which I was. I gave to the ACLU my whole life. You know, everything from The People versus Larry Flint to the Parents Music Resource Center to, you know, NWA putting out their, you know, Straight Outta Compton album to Mapplethorpe to all those things. How important those stories were at the time, you know, is up for question. But, you know, certainly you could not be politically liberal and be on the other side of those issues when I grew up. I didn't know anybody who thought differently when I went to college about this issue. And then when I went into the media, everybody was unanimous in believing, you know, an absolutely unfettered, you know, free speech, the First Amendment. I had the good fortune to live overseas in Russia and see what happened when a country both acquired speech freedoms and lost them in a very short period of time. So that experience weighed on me very heavily, and still does. You know, how quickly you can lose these things and how fragile it all is. And I think Americans, once believed that very strongly. They were always very conscious of that in their history. But when Donald Trump came around, I think that's when there was suddenly a brand new belief system, particularly in the news media, and that's one of the reasons that it's been very difficult to get anybody in the regular press to do stories about censorship, surveillance, any of those things, things that were big stories as recently as 2015, 2014.
I think we have time for a few audience questions.
I know that gentleman.
Good morning, Matt.
Hey, good morning,
Bernie. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
You, more than you've been in a long while, you're as much a businessman as an old-fashioned journalist. And you've been remarkably successful helping pioneer a new form of information. I'm just wondering how you think about that. And maybe to help frame it a little bit, you're doing this great, courageous work, but how do you spin yourself as like when you're marketing? How do you build that audience? And what are you thinking about? Or are you just thinking about doing the story and letting the chips fall as they may?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you, Bernie. We knew each other in Russia. Substack. When I first started, moved to Substack, I left Rolling Stone in 2020, where I had been for 15 years, and that was sort of it's one of the iconic gigs in American journalism, covering presidential campaign for Rolling Stone. That was Hunter Thompson's job, and I had a great time doing it for a long time, but the press in America has been in financial disarray for a long time. One editor that I know described working in media as overseeing the decline, and that's how we felt about it for years. But recently, I saw that Substack was an area where there was a growing audience, and as people were leaving conventional media, they were going to new forms of media. They were, watching shows like Joe Rogan's show or whatever. Russell Brand was another, podcaster who was very successful. But I was always thinking about I.F. Stone, who was a famous investigative journalist. He had been a conventional journalist, and he just had a printing press in his basement, and he used to put out a news weekly. And from what I understand, he made a nice living doing it, didn't have to... I heard a story about how he put a new roof on his house and didn't have to worry about how much it cost, and that was very impressive to me as a journalist. So Substack is basically, it's the modern version of what I.F. Stone did. The problem, though, and I thought this was a great business idea, it would work wonderfully, the problem is that now the distribution mechanisms have been so concentrated that if just a couple of platforms decide they want to de-amplify you, it becomes very difficult to reach new audiences. And that makes it harder to have this sort of creative destruction process, right, where the old news organizations that aren't getting the audience, they might fade away and be replaced by new independent media organizations. It's harder for that to happen because of some things that are going on in the internet. But thanks for that question.
Good afternoon. Thank you for an excellent discussion thus far. I was at a meeting last week where Newt Gingrich spoke, and he spoke about during a period where he was in the House of Representatives, he had an afternoon meeting with the Chief of Naval Operations. And during that meeting, which was very casual, he had asked me, he said, "What does it feel like when you have a new executive branch coming in? And what is your attitude at that point?" And he said, "It's as if we had summer interns and that they're going to be gone in a year or two." And My thought comes to the status of the administrative state at this point, and as to whether or not the entrenched members of the administrative state, not at the total top, but at slightly below that, do not drive this. People like McCabe at the FBI and different individuals, rather than from on high. Or is it a combination of both? But it just brought it to my mind, and I wanted to know what your feelings were on it.
That's a great question, because that's something that we weren't fully able to work out. I think, you know, people, one of the responses that we got to the Twitter files reporting was, well, didn't a lot of this happen under the Trump administration? Why would they be critical of, why would they be censoring pro-Trump content? And I think the answer is exactly what you're referencing. These organizations have interests of their own, minds of their own, and they're forever, whereas presidencies are fleeting, and presidents come and go. And we definitely did find that, you know, there was, whereas there was a kind of growing, continuous relationship, not just between these agencies and these programs, but these agencies and each other, and these agencies and certain NGOs that were recipients of increasing amounts of government aid that were going toward these new programs. It's like a new branch of the military-industrial complex, basically. And I do think that it's fundamentally a problem of this administrative state growing out of control. I think it's less partisan in nature and more about this bureaucracy that is kind of nameless and faceless and very difficult to dislodge. But that's why we need more information about how it works. And that's why we need more reporting on the subject, I think.
One more?
Hey, thank you for coming. I enjoyed your speech. I think people call it the blob. That's the term I heard for the administrative state.
Right, the blob, yes.
Just recently I saw this interview between Carlson and Bentz. Have you seen that, and do you have any comments on it?
Mm-hmm. Mike Bentz was somebody that we, all of the Twitter files reporters talked to during the reporting of these stories. He was one of just a handful of people who had been tracking a lot of these issues. But that term, the blob, that's been around. There was a senatorial aide named Jeff Conanton who wrote a book describing how difficult it was to get things done in Washington because of this network of informal relationships that exists everywhere. There, parties are irrelevant because one person is married to another person who works in a lobbying firm, and that person has a nephew who works in the NSA, and so on and so forth. And there are relationships. It's a relationship-based town. I never lived in Washington. I don't know this as well as people I've talked to know it. But I think that's essentially what we're dealing with here, is this group of people who have a conflation of interests. And what's the part that we focused on was this idea that, for instance, the press was always separate, or at least saw itself as separate from some of those institutions. It would have been heretical 15 years ago for journalists to sit around in an off-the-record meeting with members of the intelligence community and, you know, lobbyists, and talk about how to not cover a story that's coming up, all right? And that did happen. Before 2020, there was sort of a huddle about what to do about, a hack and leak story involving Hunter Biden and Burisma, and all the reporters who were present, none of them wrote about that meeting. So the press increasingly, and this was something we saw in the Twitter files too, they see themselves as partnered with this whole censorship regime. Oftentimes, a request to get something taken down, you would see a government agency go to the media, and they would say, "We think that this this has to be taken down from Twitter and Facebook. They haven't taken it down yet. And then you would see a request to Twitter or the other company saying the FBI is telling us you haven't taken this down. Are you going to? And now the company you see internally is freaking out. Not only is the FBI upset with us, but we're going to get bad press if we don't take this content down. And I think, you know, the idea here is that things work best when all these liberalizing institutions fight for their own interests. I mean, I think Cato is unique in recent times in that it stuck to its principle as opposed to becoming just another, you know, partisan mechanism. And that is the news media has not done that. It has not fought for its independence and its separateness from which it derives all of its power. And without that, you know, we're in serious trouble. If they see themselves as part of that blob, then, you know, how do we expose it without the people who are supposed to be doing the exposing? So I think it's a very scary story, and it's a difficult one to explain in a few words. But yes, that's very upsetting.